History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've come to realize they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and then to listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from men and women who have put their lives on the line so the rest of us wouldn't have to. The gentleman I have the privilege of introducing you to today spent 30 years in the United States Marine Corps. He was wounded in action during the Korean War and again in the Vietnam War, and was involved in something in between those two that he sees as even more significant. 90-year-old Bill Helton of Clovis, California, is our guest today, and we'll start with his childhood in Kentucky.
I did not like school when I was in school. From when I was about 12 years on, I always had one or two jobs. I came from a broken home. My parents divorced when I was about 6 years old, and I lived in Kentucky with grandparents. I wound up, during World War II, there was a shortage of men. It was easy to get jobs. The first job I got was on a truck when I was about 12 years old. The owner of the truck had gone into the service. He was delivering bread, and his wife had to take over. When summer came around, she wanted off, so she was able to find an old 40-year-old who couldn't read or write in Kentucky that could drive. So she hired me to go along and collect the money, do all the paperwork. And I started that, and then I worked in a bakery on the holidays, and on Saturdays and Sundays I worked in a bakery. Our chief baker at that time was 16 years old. They had permission from the schools for him to work. But I wanted in the Marine Corps. I read in the paper where young 15-year-old had his brother's birth certificate or lied about his age and got into service and was a hero. My poor mother, I drove her batty wanting to go into service. And she says, no, when you graduate from high school, I'll let you go, but not before. But I wanted to go in, and that was it.
Well, and I want everybody to hear how you pulled that off. But you mentioned World War II, and you're a child growing up in this time. You're 9 years old when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. You're telling us how badly you wanted to get into the Marine Corps. Did any of that have to do with your father's service in the Marine Corps in World War II?
It definitely did. He was 33 when he went in. He did not have to go. He was an engineer, had a wartime job that exempted him. But during World War II, it was a time where everybody wanted to go. It wasn't like, you know, I'm getting drafted, I have to go. He had to plead to get in, and he did go in at 33 and wound up in Marine Corps Aviation in the Pacific.
In fact, he spent some time as one of those rear-facing gunners on dive bombers?
He went to school in Norman, Oklahoma. They kept him there as an instructor, and after a year or so, he was able to get on, and he flew backwards. He was not wounded. The only time he was hurt in action, he said the pilot landed one time on a carrier and forgot to take the wheels down. He got a pretty bad hit over that. His claim to fame on the service or what he liked, and Norman, he would love being the payroll guard. He would go along with the payroll officer in his Marine dress uniform, carrying his Thompson submachine gun. That was the greatest part of the war. He loved weapons. Before he passed away, he had Alzheimer's, and he went through the house constantly looking for his Tommy gun.
So you knew your father had served in World War II, and these are the years just after World War II, and you're actually at a boarding school at the time, but you played a little bit of a trick on your parents to get into the Marine Corps. Can you explain that to us?
On my 17th birthday, I walked up to the principal. I was going to boarding school, Berea College in Kentucky, But I was going to high school. But anyway, on my 17th birthday, I went up and says, I quit. I'm going in the service. And he says, go home, talk it over with your parents. If you decide to come back, no problems. You're welcome to come back. Instead of going home, I hitchhiked. Hitchhiking was pretty common at that time. I hitchhiked to Cincinnati, which is about 150 miles the opposite direction from my home. Went to the recruiting station, got two copies of parents' consent forms. The recruiter's name was Nathan Hale, of all things. But anyway, I got two copies. I went to my dad lived in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I went to him and I told him that mother had signed the papers and we needed him to sign a copy, and that way we didn't have to take divorce papers. He went ahead and signed. Then I went home to my grandparents in Kentucky, and my mother was she was trying to raise two teenagers. I have a sister, and I mailed her the copy and told her that I was out of school, couldn't get back in. Dad had signed the papers, and she'd have to go to court to keep me out. My poor mother, she had no choice but to go ahead and sign. So I went in 1949, right after my 17th birthday. It was a week or so later before I could get the papers all back, but I always claim that I went in on my 17th birthday.
And how long did it take your mom and dad to figure out how you'd tricked them?
They never mentioned it to me, so I don't know how long it took. And my dad probably was glad that I was in. They both wanted me to get education.
Well, the Marine Corps would give you quite an education in Korea and Vietnam, but this is 1949 when you go in, and no one's expecting another war to break out less than a year later. And I read something in your memoirs that I wasn't familiar with or I hadn't heard about, and all the veterans I've talked to. You wrote in there that scuttlebutt was that President Truman wanted to eliminate the Marine Corps. He wanted to get rid of it?
That was no scuttlebutt. President Truman was an Army artillery captain in Europe during World War II. He stated that he was going to do away with the Marine Corps. They were a naval police force, and that was all they were going to be. After the Korean War broke out, I have been told that Truman apologized to the Marine Corps and said that had it not been for the Marine Corps, there would have been no Korea today. And if it hadn't been for Korea, there would have been no Marine Corps. So they saved each other, and Truman did go along and started supporting the Marine Corps. We went from, when the war broke out, we did not have a full division. Within a year, the Marine Corps had three full Marine divisions.
And that was an interesting mix of people in those divisions. You served with a lot of World War II veterans, even Medal of Honor recipients from World War II, but also a lot of relatively untrained teenagers. And you were a teenager, 18 years old, when you got to Korea, January of 1951. What do you remember? What was your first impression of Korea?
When I got to Korea, I'd been in the Marine Corps just about a year, probably about 13 months. And of that, 3 months was boot camp. But anyway, I figured I was an old salt. The war started July of 1950. I didn't get there until January of 51. When I got there, the Marine Corps had completed the Chosin Reservoir campaign, and they'd pulled out and had pulled back into Hungnam and had moved up to Pohang, and they were in reserve trying to recuperate. Being that the Marine Corps only had a brigade to go in initially, they had one battalion that was on a med cruise in the Mediterranean, and they took them through the canal, Suez Canal. They landed at Incheon, and their cars and clothes and everything was left at Lejeune. A lot of them never made it home. When I got to Korea, I was an old salt, even though I hadn't seen any of the battle or anything. And in March, promotions came out. And since I was an old salt with a year in service, I made corporal. And a lot of the reserves who had fought at Chosin did not get promoted. They hadn't, a lot of them had not been through boot camp.
You ended up serving with a lot of guys who had survived the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir. And I'm guessing when you got there in January, it was still pretty cold. In fact, I think you wrote that the cargo nets you climbed down off the ship were frozen.
The cargo nets were frozen. We climbed off the ship into, we had the duck, the amphibious vehicle we went ashore on, but we went down and frozen. It was cold at night. We always slept with our socks under our armpits and had to sleep with our canteens with us under our arms. And when we'd open the sea rations, you'd open a can of pork and beans, which was a choice, and it would be about like peanut brittle. Anyway, when we was on patrols, we'd open it and throw the cans over the hill and eat the crackers, and there was a chocolate wafer in there, and that was about it. The food wasn't that great.
Nor was the weather, and so we understand, because most people listening weren't there, how cold did it get, and what did you guys have to guard against some of those freezing conditions?
Up until after Chosin, the Marine Corps did not have cold weather gear. When I landed, I was wearing my dress green trousers with a battle jacket, had the leather boots. I'd say within a month, they came out with our cold weather clothing. As far as the weather, I don't really remember how cold it got, but we liked when it snowed, it was actually warm. So if you woke up warm, that means you was probably covered with snow. I never pitched tents. I would just lay on the ground and put my poncho over me, let the rain and snow or whatever would go over me.
I don't know how many people are listening to that and volunteering to be in your shoes. So here you are, you're a teenager over there, and you're getting your first tastes of combat.
We were in Po Hang recuperating from Chosin, and we went out on training patrols. On about the first patrol I went out on, company had about 200 men, and here we're stretched out, 200 men at six paces apart, going through rice paddies. All of a sudden, we heard a screech through the air, and it turned out to be a North Korean 88 weapon. It hit close to us, and of all things, one of my best friends that went over was the only one. He was killed from a piece of shrapnel from that round. With me, I think with the training I had had, basic training gives you a lot of history. We take history classes. I thought I belonged.
Well, and you mentioned, you know, losing a close friend, and you write about a time where it would have been you, that a mortar hit right in your hole, but it was a dud?
Normally, we fought in the mountains. Very seldom we were down in low ground. Again, the company would be moving through the at six paces apart, and when we would run into the enemy, there was only enough room for about one platoon. A company has three rifle platoons, and only one platoon at a time could engage the enemy. So the rest of us would dig a hole, or there was a lot of holes already dug where we'd been going back and forth. And I was laying alongside my hole, sleeping, and all of a sudden I heard a big push, and a 82-millimeter enemy mortar round had hit in my hole, and it had failed to go. Something was wrong with it. They probably didn't pull a pin out or something, but it did not go off. And had I been in the hole, I think the mortar itself would have probably done a lot of damage hitting me. But I was late. And anytime we would stop, take breaks, we were so tired from moving all day and standing watches hour on and hour off all night, we'd usually fall asleep. A couple of people would be on security, and everybody else would be sleeping. When we had to move out, they'd have to go around waking everybody up.
And just to be clear, was that common for you to sleep right outside your hole as opposed to in it? Or was that just something you did that one time that ended up saving your life?
It wasn't common, because normally I didn't have a hole. I dug very, very few holes. The only hole I remember digging, I was trying to dig with my canteen cup when we were getting shelled. But I never dug holes unless I have to. And for the first part of the Korean War, we didn't wear helmets. Latter part, they started requiring helmets. We had no flak jackets. All we had was our waterproof or winter clothing and with our parkas.
You would eventually get the Purple Heart there, but before that, you were wounded and didn't get a Purple Heart. Your tank ran over a mine? That must not have felt very good.
We were on one patrol riding a tank. The roads were mined so bad that most of the tanks would try to ride in the dried riverbeds or the riverbeds. This one time we were on a tank hit a mine, we blew off, we got blown off the tank and picked up shrapnel, didn't turn in for Purple Hearts. 2 or 3 days later, we set up in another area and a 4-point deuce mortar set up, and they didn't clear their field of fire. There was commwire went by. The mortar went off, hit the commwire, went off. Again, we got some shrapnel.
And we're going to hear about September 11th, 1951, which you referred to as the worst day of your life and what happened there. But you actually ended up on a hospital ship before that. What put you on the hospital ship?
It was dehydration. I don't know what it was, but anyway, I got evacuated. At the time, they sent me to battalion, told me to go to report to battalion aid. So I go to battalion aid. I stay there for about an hour. They says, well, we're getting heavy casualties in. So they sent me to an Army med hospital. I went there. They took my clothes off. When I got out, I got Army uniform. The one advantage that Marine, it was during the summer, Marine Corps did not have boots. Marine Corps had old field shoes with canvas leggings, and the Army had boots, so I got a pair of boots, and I had the boots for about a day, and they evacuated me to another hospital, and again, they took my clothes off. 2 or 3 hours, they said, you got to move out, so they gave me another set of new clothes and boots, and I wound up, and I went to another hospital, and then I wound up on the USS Repose hospital ship, and the nurse come behind, she assigned me a She says, you got to have a cleanup detail. And I says, no, ma'am, I'm a Marine corporal and we don't sweep down. We supervise. She says, well, either you'll sweep down or you'll go back to your unit. And I says, I want to go back to my unit. I didn't want to be here. And anyway, I got sent back to the unit. And the next day, the repos went to Japan. And I missed out on a trip of a couple of days in Japan because I wouldn't sweep down. But anyway, when I did get wounded, I would not go to the hospital.
Yeah, and I want to hear about that. But just to tie a bow on this situation so people understand, you said dehydration. I mean, it sounds like you were just pushing yourself so hard, your body was giving out on you.
That was it. I mean, this was the time when we were back trying to string our concertina wire and set it up. It got the best of me.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, a day Bill Helton calls the worst day of his life and a battle that would claim the lives of 22 Marines. Bill would be one of 245 wounded. You can find photos of Bill Helton then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this.